A very interesting book has come across my desk, and I want to recommend it to everybody because it's fascinating. It's not your typical sports story. It's got a lot of intrigue, especially international intrigue. It is called Breakaway, From Behind the Iron Curtain to the NHL, The Untold Story of Hockey's Great Escapes. And the author of this book, it's his first book, is Tal Pinchevsky. And he is a Canadian who is a staff writer and producer for NHL.com, but his work has certainly been seen on a lot of great places, and the New York Times, also the Rolling Stone, and ESPN, the magazine. What is it that, you know, that grabbed you about this story that made you want to write a book about it?
Well, obviously, growing up in Canada, I'm a lifelong hockey fan, and at a particular time when I was growing up in Montreal, the Stastny brothers over in Quebec City were just, you know, thrashing the Canadiens season after season. So they were, you could say, a big part of my childhood. And then as I got a little older and started working as a sports writer, I learned more about what they had to go through to come to Quebec City. And it's incredibly fascinating. And the more research I did, the more I realized that there were a number of stories just like this about players defecting and crossing the Iron Curtain. And I realized pretty quickly that there was definitely enough for a book.
How hard was it for you to write this book? Because obviously when you have stories with a lot of different things happening, it's hard to be able to decide or be able to verify fact from fiction.
Right. Well, obviously it kind of relied primarily on research and reporting. And I interviewed, around 50 different people for the book. That included players, coaches, scouts, lawyers, politicians, people at all, in every perspective of what happened in these stories. And I still wasn't able to really get every single person, ideally, that I would have liked to interview. So that was the real challenge, tracking down everyone that was a part of these stories, many of whom are in Europe, so trying to find them in Europe, make sure they could speak enough English that we could communicate, obviously. And, it was the most gratifying part, tracking down all these people. But at the same time, it was the biggest challenge, trying to get these stories from the perspective of the people that actually lived through it.
Speaking of perspective, tell everybody about some of the names in this book.
Sure. If you're a big hockey fan, a number of them will be familiar. Obviously, I mentioned the Stastny brothers, Peter, Anton, and Marion. There's Sergei Fedorov, the great former Red Wing, Peter Klima, Alex McGillney, Frank Musil. I mean, it's interesting when you look at it because as you sort of list these names, there's a lot of players here who had a huge influence on the game in the 80s and 90s. So I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that bringing these players over kind of helped change the game to what it is today, which I think is a perfect combination of the old North American style with the international finesse style.
At one point in my career, I was up in Seattle on television up there, and I remember when the Russian national team, came through and they were playing games, exhibition games, against the Western Hockey League. And I did a story on them, and I'll never forget the look on the faces of the Russian players as they went into some of the department stores and grocery stores in the United States. It was eye-opening for them. And I know in this book you talk about their visits outside their respective countries.
Absolutely. That's a common theme that I found with a lot of these players was, they grew up in a communist system in which they were very isolated, and they were constantly told that this decadent capitalist system in the West was evil and that it was antithetical to this greater communist system. And then they were afforded an opportunity to travel because of hockey, and they would go to these places, and they'd realize, well, this doesn't look so bad. There's a lot of, we can get blue jeans here, things that we would take for granted, like a fully stocked supermarket or being able to get blue jeans or chewing gum. Little things like that were things that were very difficult for them to do behind the Iron Curtain. So as soon as they saw all these things that at the disposal of people living in the West, they realized, well, this isn't really quite what we've been told it is. And that's, I think, where the seed gets planted. That's where these players start contemplating the idea of coming to North America, even if it means coming illegally, to make a better life for themselves and their families.
What was their lives like as athletes behind the Iron Curtain?
Well, you could definitely, I don't think anyone would argue that their lives were better, the quality of their lives were better compared to the average Czechoslovakian or the average Soviet, they were given opportunities that most regular people, if we can call them that, were not afforded. They had greater opportunities to travel. They made a bit more money. They were probably had access to nicer things like apartments or cars that the government could have a say in you know what the quality of lifestyle that certain people had. So you know what a lot of people said back then was that you know everyone is equal in the communist system, but some people are more equal. And even though it was a very isolated you know lifestyle for them, they could only play for one team and. They trained. I mean, the training that they went through was just so much more intense than the typical Western player. So it wasn't necessarily easy, but they definitely had it a bit better than the average citizen during that time.
And there were two things in which the government used over these athletes, I think. And one is certainly what you just talked about, the bennies, the advantages that they could have for them and their families as well. But intimidation and control were the other two things that they used. How did they use that?
Sure. I mean, that's where, you know, it's not like coming to North America meant just getting on a plane and flying over. There were a lot of major consequences that these players faced in coming to North America. You know, the main thing was it involved the well-being of their families. It was very understood with, you know, with the sporting apparatus in these countries and the strong central government that if these players defected, it could have an adverse effect on their families. Their parents could get fired from their jobs. If they had a sibling who played hockey, they'd probably get kicked off their team. They could be subjected to constant government surveillance. So it wasn't just affecting these players when they came over. It affected the friends and the families that they left behind. And that was the single biggest factor in the decisions they made. You know, these very brave decisions to come to North America to play hockey.
And even after they left, Hal, they were still, at least their families were still in danger in some way, were they not?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, I guess, all depends on how you would characterize, you know, being in danger. But they were definitely kind of a pariah socially. Just being associated with a defector usually meant that their friends weren't quite so friendly anymore in a lot of cases. And like I said, they could be subjected to government surveillance. Their phones would most likely be tapped. Their apartments would be tracked, their whereabouts would be tracked, and in a lot of cases, like I said before, you know, they could be fired from their jobs. There were a number of cases of the father of a defector who was, say, a coach on a team, who would suddenly get fired from his job because the central government had so much control over where people could work, and then they'd probably get rehired somewhere like as a janitor or something like that. So, you know, there were efforts to occasionally humiliate and degrade the family members of these defectors.
Tal Pinchevsky is with us. We're talking about his book, Breakaway. I want to urge you to check it out. It's a fascinating read. And in the book, you tell some stories about how some of these athletes did defect and the manner in which they did it, because it was life and death efforts. Can you go into some of the stories?
Sure. I mean, every case is a little bit different, but there's a number of examples of, you know, James Bond stuff, if you want to call it that. I mean, we're talking about players with, you know, these sort of these secret agents hired by teams and representatives from teams trying to sneak across the border with you know, KGB or other, you know, communist servicemen trying to track them down. We're talking about men with guns, men who, if they caught them and brought them back to the Soviet Union or brought them back to Czechoslovakia, would more than likely throw them in prison immediately. So, you know, the stakes were incredibly high, and just, you know, one slip up, one wrong turn, one little thing here or there could mean a failed attempt at defection, and that could literally mean being escorted by the military, you know, back to their home country, and who knows what could happen from there.
Do you have one particular scenario that you still kind of shake your head at when you think about it?
Yeah, I get asked that every once in a while, and I keep coming back to the story of the Stastny brothers. I mean, it's just so fascinating. They got to make a movie about these guys eventually. Everything's so incredibly unprecedented. You have these three brothers from Bratislava, and not only do they play on the same team, they play on the same line together, and they're just absolutely dominant. They're leading this new age of Czechoslovakian dominance in international hockey. And they all want to defect, and in the end, two of the brothers make it, and the third doesn't. So, you know, the oldest brother, Marian, was left behind because he had a family, and just the idea of going to this new country, this new culture, knowing that you left behind your brother, and that because of the decisions you made, your brother is going to be fired, you know, kicked off the national team, is going to be under government surveillance. I mean, his life is effectively over, and this is an older brother who has a wife and three kids. So, and he joined them eventually a year later, but it's just the highs and lows emotionally are just incredible.
Yeah, what is it like for the families who are left behind then?
I mean, it varies. It varies from case to case. Near the end of the Cold War, when things were really starting to thaw, and the system, the communist system, was starting to fall apart, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't maybe quite as bad as it was before. But almost across the board, you know, these players would defect and then call their parents, and they just knew, and their calls were being tapped. Every call, you know, more often than not, would be tapped in these families' homes. There was a lot you could do to make their lives more difficult, like I said, like firing them from their jobs or interrogating them. But I think the main thing for them was just that scarlet letter that they wore, because they were now known as the family of defectors. And because of that, people were afraid that if they were caught having a conversation with them, then maybe they would look suspicious, and maybe they would be interrogated by the KGB or who knows. And it wasn't easy. Never mind the fact that, you know, you have a child who you don't know if you're ever going to see them again. You know, that was the main thing, that these players would defect. And, you know, and Peter Nedved defected and the Cold War ended a year later, but he didn't. But he was 17, and there was no way for him to know that. So he left his family without telling them, not knowing if he'd ever see them again. I mean, it was just hard to imagine.
Is it any different today? Of course it is different, but, I mean, are there still some pressures that come about today with an athlete that wants to leave his country?
I mean, it's different, obviously. I mean, the Cold War is over, and politically these countries are incredibly different. You know, I think it changes things. The main difference is how we develop this talent now. I mean, we have young players as young as 16 and 17 crossing borders, you know, these open borders. We have 16 and 17-year-old Russians coming to Canada to play junior hockey, you know, and then we obviously have North American players going to Russia or the Czech Republic to play professional hockey there. That would have been completely unthinkable, you know, just 20, 25 years ago. So, I mean, that's the main difference, that now these players all over the world have a choice. They can choose where they want to play, which was not, you know, that was obviously not the case during the Cold War. You were assigned to a team depending on how talented you were, and you were basically owned in perpetuity by that team. They told you when you played. If, you know, it's not like you could hold out for a new contract or demand a trade. That wasn't even a question. So those are the main differences today.
We've got about 90 seconds left, and I know with my friends who are Hispanic or Caribbean, the ball players that came that were kind of the pioneers of that movement to Major League Baseball talked about the difficulty of assimilating into the American culture. What was it like for those players?
Oh, absolutely. That's another thing. I think the perception was these guys would come to North America and that was it. They were millionaires. They had made it, you know, and that was the end of the story. But in many cases, that's just where the problems begin. You know, you have a completely different language, a completely different system, a different culture. You have athletes, many of whom don't speak the language that well. You know, the ultimate irony is Peter Stastny, for example, spent all this time learning English because he wanted to defect. He ends up going to Quebec City where they speak French. So he had to learn a new language there. But then just simple things. You know, these guys had never had a credit card before. They'd never had a checking account before. If they went to a grocery store, they better pick up everything in the grocery store right away because it might not be there the next day. Whereas in North America, you go in a grocery store, you have 20 different kinds of cereal. So a lot of this was very overwhelming. And, you know, some of them brought girlfriends and wives who didn't have the distractions that the players had. You know, these hockey players could get, you know, they had practice, they had games, they had road trips. They had distractions from this difficult transition. But for their wives or their children, they didn't have that. And it could be really problematic.
We've got about 20 seconds left. Are you happy with the way this book came out?
I am. I'm very pleased. You know, I was so fortunate that so many people were just very open and honest and candid with me, and the response has been great so far. And I'm happy with how it all turned out.
Well, congratulations on the book. I'm fascinated with the topic, and I hope everybody will check it out. Thanks a lot, Tal. Come back and join us again on Sports Byline.
Thanks so much, Ron. Anytime.
And check out this book. It's called Breakaway, From Behind the Iron Curtain to the National Hockey League, The Untold Story of Hockey's Great Escapes. And it's a very interesting subject, one I've not seen before. We continue with more of you and America's Sports Talk Show.